streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Monday, March 28th. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia to our campus, to residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca. It is now 5:09 p.m. and time for another almost full hour of independent news. Our news will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We'll also be talking to Brian Vincent from STOP and UBC Animal Research, as well as Anne Lemire, Executive Director of Society for Children and Youth of BC, and to some experts on the Blackout Speak Out movement. All this, plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. And now, for our coverage of STOP UBC Animal Research's protest this past weekend. So, on Sunday, June 3rd, yesterday, STOP UBC Animal Research staged a provocative protest at the Canadian Association for Laboratory Animal Sciences, or CALAS, symposium at the Sheraton Wall Centre Hotel in Vancouver. So with us on the phone right now, we have Brian Vincent, director of STOP UBC Animal Research, who will fill us in on some of those details. So Brian, it's good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what can you tell us about, first of all, what CALAS was and what was the symposium?
Well, it's ironic that the acronym is CALAS, because that's exactly what they promote, is a CALAS attitude towards animals. The Canadian Association for Laboratory Animal Science essentially aids and abets in a systematic abuse of animals throughout Canada. It trains people to experiment on animals. And as we know, there's an extensive animal research program at UBC where nearly a quarter of a million animals were used in research in 2010. About 3 million animals or more than that used in Canada, across Canada in 2010 as well.
And so what's UBC's specific ties to CALAS? I mean, were there a lot of researchers there, or were there departmental presentations? Or?
Well, there were workshops given at the symposium. In fact, they'll be given the next few days, where participants will be trained how to remove the adrenal glands from mice, or to cut up and suture rodents, restrain rabbits who can panic from being restrained and actually damage their spinal columns as a result. So they're essentially training people how to experiment on animals, and they provide that training to institutions across Canada. They service all those institutions that do experimentation on animals, including UBC.
And what kind of participation or attendance did we see at this event?
You know, like a lot of issues surrounding animal experimentation in Canada, it's very secretive. Much of the animal research done in Canada is behind closed doors, it's very hush-hush, so it's very difficult to get information. The only information we could get from CALAS was through their website, where they listed the symposium and included some of the workshops. But it's very difficult to get information about animal research in Canada.
Okay, well, it's good to hear about that. And moving on now to what STOP UBC Animal Research did, can you give us a rundown of what the protests looked like?
Well, it was 10 people dressed in biohazard suits with surgical masks, flanking a dissection table that was quite large, about 7 feet high, 6 feet wide. And on the dissection table, which was erected vertically, was a woman in a white sheet splattered in blood. And she was essentially restrained on the dissection table, much like an animal at one of these workshops. It should be noted that all the animals used in these training sessions for CALAS will be killed. So they're essentially guinea pigs for trainees.
That's definitely a very provocative display visually. And obviously you're going to have a lot of response from that. On the one hand, of course, you're going to have public passerby reacting. On the other hand, the actual participants in the symposium. So can you speak a bit to these different reactions that you saw, and if there was a difference between the people actually at the symposium and the public and the people just seeing it on the street?
Well, the people who came by certainly were taken aback on it by it, but you know, it's interesting that somebody would think it's provocative. What I find is provocative is what's happening at UBC, where monkeys are administered electroconvulsive shock without anesthesia, where chemicals are injected into their brains to cause seizures, where cats, the backs of cats are cut open and screws are inserted into their spines. Mice are exposed to cigarette smoke. That's provocative. We were simply trying to show the public in a dramatic way, what happens behind the closed doors of a laboratory. This all isn't neat and tidy. These are lives at stake. Animals are exposed to inhumane treatment. If you were to conduct any of the procedures on your neighbor's cat or dog, you'd be brought up on cruelty to animal charges. Yet, in the name of science, you can literally burn an animal alive in Canada. The Canadian Council on Animal Care has five categories of invasiveness that they list. The most invasive procedures allow you to do things like burn an animal alive, shove toxins down their throat, cause extreme pain to these animals. That is legal in Canada.
And just speaking a bit more to what Stop UBC Animal Research does, I know on your website you've outlined some alternatives to animal research that you think are preferable. Could you just go into a few of these for our listeners?
Sure. Well, it's important to note that animal research is not only cruel and unnecessary, it often ignores the root cause of illness and is misleading for humans. Let's take obesity. Obesity is well known what causes obesity. Poor lifestyle, sedentary lifestyle without exercise, unhealthy diet, stress, right? We know what causes obesity. Yet, millions, if not billions, are poured into making monkeys fat. So an alternative would be, let's focus on getting rid of those things that make people obese, getting rid of fast food, introducing a whole new healthy school lunch program, bringing exercise to the workplace, reducing stress. There are a number of steps we can take that get at the root cause of illness without animals having to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, animal research is quite misleading. Let's take Vioxx. Vioxx was a medication developed for management of arthritis. It was pulled from the market in 2008 because it killed more than 100,000 people. It was deemed safe after many animal tests, including on non-human primates. So just because a medication is determined to be safe on animals, doesn't mean that it translates to being safe on humans, and in fact can be quite dangerous.
Right. Well, it's good to hear that those alternatives have been thought of by Stop UBC Animal Research. And going back to the protests and the symposium, do you think that the protests you had would had any lasting impact, either on the researchers at the symposium or on public awareness of what's going on?
Well, I think if you look at prior to our campaign, we launched in 2010, there was very little awareness about what UBC was doing to animals. Now, I think more and more people are learning that, more than 200,000 animals are used in 1 year at UBC in 2010. Some of those animals were exposed to extremely painful and invasive procedures. Monkeys had to be put down at UBC because they had been so impaired by brain research on them. So this is now out into the public, sphere, and people can debate whether they want their tax dollars to be used for this sort of thing. So I think from that perspective, we've lifted the veil of secrecy on UBC, and now we can facilitate a debate about what to do next. Is this acceptable to society? And if not, what do we do?
Awesome. Well, it was great talking to you today, Brian. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So once again, that was Brian Vincent from Stop UBC Animal Research talking about the recent protests that his organization held downtown at the Canadian Association for Laboratory Animal Science Symposium on Sunday. So we were glad to talk to him today. So now, We're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia here in Vancouver. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Kurgia.
And it's great to have you with us today.
We have lots of interviews in store. We will not stop now.
So please do stay with us.
Charts, babe.
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle.
And I'm Nina Krigia. And now we have an interview with Jim Boothroyd, Director of Communications of the David Suzuki Foundation. He talked to us earlier about Blackout Speak Out, which was just a conglomeration of organizations and businesses that happened today in which thousands of individual Canadians were uniting in collective defense of nature and democracy as part of the campaign. It is known as Silence on Parle in French, and it is a nationwide day of action in which Canadians darkened their websites, wrote to their elected representatives, and spoke out through social media to protest the federal government's smear attacks on charities, gutting of environmental laws, and efforts to silence the voices of concerned citizens. And we will now go to the interview. So I have Jim Boothroyd here, Director of Communications from the David Suzuki Foundation. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Nina.
So I wanted to just ask you if you could tell us a little bit about Blackout Speak Out.
Yeah, Blackout Speak Out is a national campaign that began a month ago and culminated today, Blackout Monday.
It's the planet's only electric.
Created by the 12 leading environmental organizations in the country. It's grown to be, and its focus was on the government's smear attacks on environmental charities and the omnibus budget bill, C-38, which includes in its 400 pages some really incendiary legislation, gutting of the Fisheries Act, and other significant environmental laws, most notably the rewriting of the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act. The aim here was to stand up and in support of the core Canadian values of the protection of nature and democracy, and call on.
And we're just about set to go. It's been bedlam all around LA Live.
Today, the campaign culminated with 530 partner organizations, including trade unions representing millions of workers, such as the Canadian Labor Congress, a whole range of conservation groups, businesses like Claridge Incorporated, clothing companies. We've had an extraordinary outpouring of support for this.
What, now that it has finished, I mean, it's the end of a work day now. Are you guys planning on continuing this? What is the next step?
This is really meant to place a stake in the sand and say to our supporters and the groups that there are over 1 million people who support the 12 environmental organizations who initiated the campaign. The aim here was to say to our supporters and say to a broader place, provide a place for Canadians who are concerned about the direction of the government to join in voicing their concern. Next steps will, you'll probably see a broadening out of this campaign. I don't know what the exact steps will be. There will be an emphasis in coming months and in the coming year or two on reminding Canadians of the really tangible, concrete benefits that the charitable sector provides to the country in terms of economic benefits, social benefits, and its contributions to politics and just good formation of policy. These are all things that have been under attack by the federal Conservative government. There will also be, I think, further work across sectors in terms of protecting the core Canadian values of the protection of nature and democracy. And I'm not sure exactly what those elements will be.
Yeah,
it's all happened very quickly,
yeah.
And it's curried extraordinary favor among a whole range of groups. So I suspect that the creative initiatives will grow out of this, Nina.
Yeah, and was it what you expected? Was it bigger, smaller? What was the scope
bigger? We expected that we would be able to rally the environmental sector, and we didn't really know what would come of this, but we knew there was a deep vein of anger.
Mm-hmm.
Among Canadians, and you know, we've seen today the Honorable John Fraser, a former fisheries minister, standing alongside First Nations, trade unionists, and environmental organizations. This hasn't happened in a long time.
Yeah.
And so it's been a remarkable growth of this campaign in such short order. And just for all your listeners, anyone who hasn't checked out the Blackout Speak Out website should go there today and sign the petition. If you're,
yep.
Take a look at the information on the site and sign the petition speaking out against the attacks on nature and democracy.
Definitely, and there's also a Twitter hashtag, Blackout
yep.
Speak Out.
Yeah.
And what I was also going to ask is I understand this is becoming very broad. A lot of things are being incorporated, but are you guys going to try and separate specifics and kind of have specific goals? Because I know that once something like this becomes too broad, maybe its points start to get lost. Or are you guys still in the works?
Yeah, no, we're not planning. We don't have any concrete plans beyond this point. I think the most important thing is that we've demonstrated a tremendous amount of cross-sectoral support for efforts to protect democracy and protect our environment, and we can build on this. In terms of the focus of it, the focus is very much on those two core Canadian values. There are a lot of groups that are concerned about building healthy communities, for instance, and you can't do that unless you have protections of the environment.
Definitely. I'm starting to sense an echo of Occupy, but with more organization here.
Yeah, the Occupy movement is inspiring.
Yeah.
And we've, I think that this is tapping into some of that discontent. But also just a sense, I think a lot of Canadians, this is in some ways a much more conservative campaign in some ways than the Occupy movement was,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that I think a lot of conservative voters, people who voted for the Harper government,
yeah.
Are troubled by what they see in the particularly hyperbolic language used by the government against environmental charities and others,
yeah.
The references to environmental group money laundering.
And with the ending of the Kyoto Protocol.
A combination of things like that, yeah. A whole list of things are happening, and they're happening in rapid succession, and this is a government on a really reckless course.
Yeah.
And I think soft conservatives are concerned about this. The disrespect for Parliament that's being shown by the omnibus budget bill is something that will rankle folks on the right as well as the left. And we're seeing that in the support that we've had for this campaign. One of the groups that is one of our partners, Strange Bedfellows, is the National Citizens Coalition, which I believe is the former employer of Stephen Harper. So, and that's a group that calls for a greater freedom through less government. but at the same time is a group that advocates for free and open democratic discussion. They're very troubled by the direction that the federal Tory government are going right now.
I know that in the past there's been a lot of West Coast as opposed to East Coast, I don't know if I would say tension, but just different points of view.
Yeah.
Are you guys attracting people from the East Coast as well?
Yeah, this is very national in scope. The Claridge Incorporated, one of the Bronfman companies that's supporting this campaign, is based in Montreal. There was a media event in St. John's, Newfoundland this morning in support of Black Oak Speak Out. Other events in Montreal, Ottawa, Winnipeg, Yellowknife, Calgary, and in Vancouver. I beg your pardon, in Yellowknife and Calgary there was media work being done. There weren't specific news conferences, but really broad support from across the country.
That's very interesting to hear, just because I know that there's been a lot of different points of view. That sounds really cool. That sounds like a really big scope. I didn't know that it expanded as much as it has. So I wish you the best with everything. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Nina. My pleasure.
Okay. Talk
Bye-bye.
To you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Jim Boothroyd from the David Suzuki Foundation. If you would like to know any more information about Blackout Speak Out, or if you would like to sign the petition, you can go to www.blackoutspeakout.ca.
And now it's time for our weekday weather forecast with our very own Phil Chang from the UBC Storm Club. So, hi, Phil.
Hey.
Hey, Phil.
Thank you, Claire. Good evening, listeners. We're likely to see a great deal of precipitation in store for us this week due to two active weather systems coming over us one after the other. The first one, the culprit for rain tonight and tomorrow, is a low-pressure system originating from down south in the United States. Its movement north is being driven by the nature of air masses to head in the direction of most negative pressure tendency. In this case, it's in our direction. So, after this first system leaves, soon to follow up on Wednesday evening is another low-pressure system, this one hitting us from the direction of the Pacific Ocean. Seamlessly filling the upper air vacancy over our city, the second system brings a load of water of its own to distribute over our region. So this is why one should really get mentally prepared for lots and lots of rain this week. All right, so ready or not, here is your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC. Tonight, overcast with 70% chance of rain, anticipate about 5 millimeters total, low of 11. Tuesday, overcast with 90% chance of rain, anticipating 10 millimeters of rain in total. Winds could hit 20 kilometers per hour. High of 14, low of 10. Wednesday, we are expecting a partly cloudy morning and overcast with 60% chance of rain at night. Around 10 millimeters expected. High of 15, low of 12. Thursday, overcast with rain during evening and afternoon, accumulating up to 15 millimeters, high of 15, low of 11. And Friday, overcast with 70% chance of rain, anticipating 10 millimeters, high of 16, low of 9. So that's your five-day weekday weather forecast for UBC this week, brought to you by the UBC Storm Club. Currently it is 11 degrees on UBC campus. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang.
Thanks, Phil. That was Phil Chang giving us the weekday weather forecast. It doesn't look very nice, but you know what? We love Phil, so we're going to take it. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back on CITR 101.9 FM.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
And welcome back to CITR News 101. Sorry about the break there. We're having a bit of technical difficulties here in studio, but don't worry, your intrepid news team is on it and going to fix it right away.
And now we have Andrea Lemire here. She is with the Society for Children and Youth of BC, who received notice from the Human Rights Program from the Department of Canadian Heritage via email that the Human Rights Program funding for support awareness for human rights issues was, quote, eliminated as part of the Canadian Government of Canada's 2012 budget and is therefore no longer available, end quote. And Andrea is going to tell us the specific backlash and the consequences of that funding cut. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, Nina. We received information. Actually, they didn't have us on a newsletter. We had been contacting them pretty consistently since October, trying to find out what was going on with the program. They were revamping it first, and after a number of phone calls and emails, we finally got the information that the program had been cut.
So what were the implications, what is the consequence now that the funding has been cut?
Well, the funding is quite important because this is, well, for two reasons. One is that it's Canada's obligation under these different United Nations conventions that the Canadian government will support public awareness around rights. So specifically in this context around children's rights and rights for people with disabilities. And they, when they sign on, when they ratify the convention, it says that they agree that they are responsible to raise public awareness about this. So that's one part of the importance, is that without the funds, it's really hard for them to keep their responsibilities.
Yeah.
The second part of that is, of course, that the public won't be aware or won't be as aware about what rights that they do have under these conventions. And this is, of course, very important because to know about your rights, you're able to advocate for your own rights or for the rights of people around you who may not be able to advocate for themselves.
So who are the main people that you guys deal with and you help at the SCY?
Well, we are a provincial organization, and we started 37 years ago advocating for the well-being of children and youth. And well-being is quite a broad term, I understand, but so is the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. So this can be anything that affects the well-being of children, anything to do with physical, emotional, spiritual, developmental well-being. It's quite broad.
Yeah, it seems quite broad. Sorry, we can't really hear you very much. I don't know if it's our system. Maybe you could speak a tiny bit louder.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. So now that the funding is cut, is there any other way that people can be getting this information?
There is. There are different provincial responsibilities as well. So the MCFD, Ministry of Children and Family Development, they do train their social workers on children's rights, which is fantastic. The Representative for Children and Youth, they also do advocacy work and promotion within children who receive governmental services. And we as a society, we host a child rights public awareness campaign, and that campaign has been funded through various grants and foundations, as well as the United Way of the Lower Mainland and the representative's office. And there's a website people can see for more information, and that's everychild.ca. And that's a site where adults can learn all about their responsibilities and the opportunities they have to uphold children's rights.
And now that the funding has been cut from the government, will there be private grants, or will there be private organizations that can still keep it up, or what is the future?
We hope so. If anyone knows of any fantastic foundations, they're welcome to find us and let us know. It's a pretty challenging funding situation because people recognize that rights are important.
Yeah.
But because it's not direct service, it's awareness building, sometimes it's harder to find that support. So we are now in a challenging position.
Yeah, and it's interesting because you would think that with government issues such as this, there's always funding. That's always been my thinking when it comes to human rights, and when it comes to specific issues like that, they're so important for the Canadian government that you wouldn't think that the funding would be cut from something like that.
Absolutely. It was very surprising to us. They did write in that message that this was the interesting quote, was that they said, the decision, and this is, I'm quoting out of the email that they sent me, the decision to eliminate the funding component of the human rights program does not affect in any way Canada's commitment to promoting human rights, and the program will continue to promote international human rights treaties throughout other outreach and promotional activities.
Okay.
Now, we've sent them an email, about a week ago now, asking them what that quote-unquote other outreach and promotional activities entails, and they have not let us know. So it would be great if they're still doing something,
mm-hmm.
but we have no idea at this point what that would be or what that is.
Yeah, and that's interesting. It kind of ties into a lot of funding has been being cut by the government in various aspects. We were just talking to someone else from Blackout Speak Out who was also talking about funding cutting from various aspects, from environmental issues to other human rights issues. So it's just interesting to see that your guys' funding was also cut. So it's kind of, I see that it's becoming a big issue everywhere in Canada in terms of the government. And yeah, that's a pretty contradictory statement that they cut the funding, but saying that there continue to be human rights, even though the funding for you guys, which is promoting human rights, has been cut.
Absolutely. And it's not it is not funding to us specifically. It's funding to any organization who is applying for a grant through this program. So it's open to universities, it's open for research, and anyone who was looking for a grant or who has, I'm assuming that people who have ongoing grants, that they'll fulfill their obligations with those, but then the granting stream has been cut off.
Yeah.
So future work has been cut off.
Definitely.
And with the government cuts, there has been a lot of cuts around youth. So youth internship projects have been cut, youth volunteer support has been cut. And this is just one more example. So definitely the students out there need to make their voices heard and let the government know what type of Canada they want to live in.
Yeah, what type of Canada they're going to be ruling in the future.
Absolutely. What services are important to them? Which values are important to them? Are human rights and learning about human rights an important value that we share as Canadians? Then we need to fund it.
Exactly. Well said. Okay, thank you so much for speaking with us. And just to remind everybody, it is everychild.ca, the link that you can go to learn more.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks, Andrea.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
So that was Andrea Lemire, Executive Director of the Society for Children and Youth of BC, talking to us about the funding cut from the Canadian government. We are going to take a quick break and we'll be right back at CITR.ca. Whoa, at news at 101.9 FM.
Or online at CITR.ca.
Either way.
Winnie Cooper presents the Thursday Concert Series at 560. With one of the biggest video walls in North America, 560 is quickly becoming one of the nicest venues Vancouver has to offer. It currently houses four floors, each presenting you with a different musical vibe. In the coming months, the Thursday Concert Series will showcase some of the biggest local and international acts to hit town. The Thursday Concert Series at 560 Club, located at 560 Seymour Street in Vancouver, BC, presented by Winnie Cooper.
Liveband.com is Vancouver's community-driven concert calendar. New shows are added daily by the
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Claire Eagle. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. We are now joined on the phone by Zach Crispin from the Canadian Federation of Students, the BC chapter. And Zach is just going to talk to us a bit about their recent press release on the belief that the Premier's focus on international student engagement is not going to be that successful. So welcome to the show, Zach.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what can you tell us initially about this plan of the Premier's?
So essentially what this is coming from is a few months ago, as part of a tour that the Premier is doing around the province, sort of making promises to people around the different places in BC, she said that she was going to increase the number of international students in post-secondary institutions in British Columbia by 50%. Tens of thousands of international students coming to British Columbia, essentially enough international students to create a whole new mid-sized university in British Columbia, but the Premier didn't say how she was going to fund any of these programs or infrastructure or programming at post-secondary institutions already in BC. And so the Canadian Federation of Students had a lot of questions about that, and we had a lot of concerns considering that she didn't attach any funding to it. And then recently, the government came out with this international education strategy, which essentially highlights a system that says that we're gonna benefit from bringing international students to BC, charge them highly inflated tuition fees, and essentially make them pay for domestic seats. So really not a great situation for students in British Columbia.
And I guess looking at this realistically, I mean, you mentioned, of course, the fact that they want to attract the size of a new mid-sized university to BC, but without actually improving the funding at all. And I'm sure this is one of the questions that you did ask the Premier. And did you have any answers to that?
Well, I mean, the Premier is essentially claiming that the current infrastructure for post-secondary education can handle this massive influx, which it simply can't. Mm-hmm. And in fact, not only is the government not increasing core funding for programming and whatnot for institutions, it's actually decreasing the amount of funding that it already provides for BC's current international and domestic students. So, students are paying higher tuition fees, funding is going down, and the Premier wants to squeeze, another few thousand students into BC.
Right, and have you heard anything about the response that professors and support staff have been given to this? Because obviously, a lot of this burden will actually fall on them as well as on the students in the system right now. Has there been any sort of response or outcry from that region?
Well, I mean, I think what staff and faculty of institutions want is properly funded institutions and enough faculty to provide for all the students that are in the programs, and then the
the faculty unions and faculty organizations in BC, largely agree that tuition fees are a barrier to post-secondary education, and that we're working to eliminate those barriers. So I can't imagine that that they're too happy about an announcement that such as this that comes completely without any without a proper funding model.
Of course, and just wondering as well about the Canadian Federation of Students' opinion on the longevity of really extorting, essentially, these international students and really just squeezing them for everything that we can get out of them. I mean, obviously, the growth of like more global world and international education and a lot more mobility has resulted in so many international students. But it definitely is true that they're being charged quite an exorbitant fee to have the privilege to come study here. And do you see this as being something that's sustainable moving into the future, or do you think we're going to see some sort of pushback from international students?
Well, I don't think it's sustainable. And you mentioned mobility, and one of the great things about international education and bringing people to British Columbia. I mean, I think there's a lot of good reasons for bringing some international students to BC and having spots available for international students. I think that that's a good thing. I don't think that anyone's saying that we shouldn't have international students in BC. But what the premier said, and when people have asked her, are these students coming here to stay in Canada, or are they coming here just for this education? And the premier has really said that what she wants, in her words, is to bring these people to Canada, charge them high tuition fees, and put them through the system, and then they'll go home to their own home country to be ambassadors, quote unquote. But really, what we're doing is we're bringing people to BC, we're charging them extremely high tuition fees, and part of the plan is to attract them to BC's private schools, which are of a far lower quality than the public schools. And so I can't see those folks becoming ambassadors when they come and they're promised a system of high quality. And then they could attend a system of low quality private school. So I think that what we're going to see is a cohort of students come in, have a look around and realize that they're getting milked as cash cows essentially, and then go home to their home country and say it's just simply not worth it. Especially since the government is not planning to make Canada as accessible to these folks in the sense that it won't be any easier for them to come stay and become Canadians.
Wow, that sounds like it is something that we're going to have to look at in the future. And I'm just wondering if you can relate any of what's happening right here in terms of just like sort of the cuts to funding for education and so on to the unrest that we're seeing with students in Quebec. I mean, obviously, they're quite different situations. And one, it's the tuition hike, whereas here it's sort of pushing more into our infrastructure that our infrastructure can't handle. But I think in both situations, it comes down to students being less than satisfied with the way the government is handling their education and not putting the attention that students really deserve into their education. And do you feel like there's any tie to what's happening in Quebec right now in this broader movement of student unrest?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, tuition fees are going up in BC. The same kind of hikes that we're seeing in Quebec right now, where it took place about a decade ago here in BC, and students are still paying for that hike, and tuition fees are going up each year in British Columbia. And so, the average student debt in BC is at graduation is $27,000, and in Quebec it's far lower. So students in BC are trying to fight this massive debt that we have. We're trying to fight for lower tuition fees, and we've been doing a lot. We've had several solidarity rallies with Quebec and had a day of action on February 1st to call for reduced tuition fees. But what's going on in Quebec is really an inspiration to students, and I think that we're going to see a lot of political activity of students in the next semester and when everyone's back on campus, really drawing from what's going on there. And the Quebec system is an accessible, sort of good, really good model for education in Canada, and I think that the government should be working.
Oh, I think we lost you there. Oh no,
I'm still here.
Oh no. Okay, sorry. You just cut out for a second. Yeah. Great. Well, I guess just to wrap up then, what kind of things do you think students could do right now if this is an issue that's concerning them? Is there any action that they could take?
Absolutely. If students want to get involved with, solidarity actions with Quebec and also putting pressure on our current government, they can, they can go to our website, cfs.bc.ca, or check out our Facebook page, Death Sentence, if you just search for Death Sentence at Facebook, get involved with all of the campaign work of the Federation of BC.
Awesome. Great. Well, it was so good chatting to you today. Thanks for taking the time out to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. Bye-bye, Zach.
Bye.
Okay. So that was Zach Crispin from the Canadian Federations of Students, the BC chapter. And he was just chatting with us about the international education strategy promised by the Premier and why the CFS thinks that is not going to be a success. Just to give you some background on what the CFS is, it's the BC chapter is composed of post-secondary students from 16 universities and colleges in every region of BC. And so they do have a pretty broad-based understanding about student issues here. So if you would like to find out more about that, you can always look up the Canadian Federation of Students online. We are now going to go to our health segment. Not our health segment.
I think we're going to take a very quick break, and then we'll be back with our health segment.
Winnie Cooper presents the Thursday Concert Series at 560. With one of the biggest video walls in North America, 560 is quickly becoming one of the nicest venues Vancouver has to offer. It currently houses four floors, each presenting you with a different musical vibe. In the coming months, the Thursday Concert Series will showcase some of the biggest local and international acts to hit town. The Thursday Concert Series at 560 Club, located at 560 Seymour Street in Vancouver, BC, presented by Winnie Cooper.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. It's now time for our weekly health segment with Sharon Hundle and her team of dietitian students. So it's now time for dietitian intuition.
Hey everyone, and welcome to Dietetics Intuition, where each week we bust nutrition myths, give tips, and do book reviews, and even interviews. You name it. This is your source for precise nutrition advice. So what are we going to talk about this week, Sharon?
Okay, so now that it's June, it's important to know that it's National Cancer Survivor Month. So the national cancer agencies have released new guidelines on nutrition and physical activity. This happens every 5 years to help people reduce their risk of developing cancer within their lifetime, and this is based on new data that comes out. So why is this important for you to know? The fact is, most variation in cancer risk across populations is actually not due to genetic factors, but it's rather lifestyle factors. So a perfect example would be smoking, and it's responsible for one-third of all cancer deaths. So another one-third of cancer deaths can also be attributed to diet, physical activity habits, including being overweight and obesity. So in light of this, we'll look at studies and talk to experts regarding cancer nutrition in the news over the next couple of weeks. Over this week, I'll even try to book an interview with a dietitian who works in this area. So look forward to that.
Yep. So for our Monday health tip, in line with our monthly health observation here, June Cancer Survivor Awareness Month, besides avoiding tobacco, maintaining a healthy weight, being physically active, and consuming a healthy diet can substantially reduce one's risk of developing or dying from cancer. So we have three trusted resources that help you do just that. You can always call 811. This is HealthLink BC, where you can actually get in touch with a dietitian who specifically works in oncology, and he or she will be there to answer all of your questions 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. You can also go to Dietitians of Canada website. They have lots of information on diet, cancer, and healthy eating. Also, RD411. You can search for very specific topics that you're interested in, such as sugar and cancer or meat in relation to cancer. So those are some great resources.
And that's RD411.com, right?
RD411.com, right. It is. So that's it for this week, but before we go, we have a bit of news of our own.
Okay, so in the works is our Dietetics Intuition blog that we just set up today, and so we're really excited about that. But over this next week, we'll keep you posted on our official launch, which will have a lot of content on the website. And yeah.
Thanks for tuning in again.
Stay happy and healthy, Vancouver.
Back to CITR News 101.
Dietitian Intuition.
With Sharon. So thank you to Sharon and her team for our weekly health news. We're now just going to bring you one international headline to close out our show. So we're going to go to Free Speech Radio News for that.
Federal authorities will implement the controversial immigration enforcement program, Secure Communities, in Washington, D.C. tomorrow. City council members and local residents are fighting the move by bringing legislation to a vote this week to mitigate the program's impact on the city's large immigrant population. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
When your human rights are under attack, what do you do?
Stand up, fight back!
When your human rights are under attack, what do you do?
Stand up, fight back!
When your human rights are under attack...
Immigrants' rights advocates joined public officials on Monday to protest the Department of Homeland Security's decision to activate the Secure Communities program in the District of Columbia. The federal program was initially optional, and D.C. was the first of many local jurisdictions, from Santa Clara, California, to Cook County, Illinois, to opt out. But federal officials changed their stance last summer and announced that Secure Communities is mandatory. D.C. resident Lisbeth Mateo with the Immigrant Youth Alliance told FSRN she's concerned the fingerprint sharing system will encourage racial profiling in D.C., and put the city's immigrant population at risk by making them afraid to report crimes to the local police.
For many years, we've been living in fear. We've been living, like, sort of behind the scenes, like hiding, not wanting to get attention to our situation or to ourselves, because we fear that if we speak out or we say something about our status, that we will get deported, that we will be jailed. And that's what living in the shadow feels like, you know, that you have to be ashamed, that you have to be afraid of what could happen.
Mateo, who came from Mexico with her parents as a young child, came out of the shadows herself only a few years ago after a traumatic incident motivated her to stand up for other undocumented youth.
I was unfortunately almost molested by a family member, and I didn't report that. I didn't call the police, even though I wanted to. I really wanted to, but I didn't because I was afraid of being questioned by the police and, you know, having my parents be questioned. And so that's all I could think of, you know, would there be another 15-year-old, 14-year-old in the city who is never going to report a crime that happens to them or their families because of that fear?
On Tuesday, the D.C. City Council will vote on a bill introduced by Phil Mendelson, which narrows the scope of the program, so only those over 18 years of age and charged with a violent crime are targeted.
We're not going to be cooperating with immigration authorities and hold people indefinitely. And we're not going to cooperate with immigration authorities and hold people on mere suspicion when they haven't been convicted of a crime of violence.
Starting Tuesday, local police will have to share the fingerprints of everyone booked with the Department of Homeland Security. But Mendelson says his bill would bar the police from detaining undocumented individuals who pose no threat to public safety. The bill also demands the federal government reimburse any local D.C. funds spent complying with the program. In addition to safety and human rights concerns, Councilmember Michael Brown and other D.C. officials also oppose the federal immigration program as an additional violation of the district's right to self-governance.
Anytime the federal government and the United States Congress wants to impose their will on the District of Columbia, we should always fight against it. We should always take the resident side, our citizen side, our D.C. taxpayer side against anybody that tries to impose their will on our jurisdiction.
As the council takes up the bill, local groups and the city's Office of Latino Affairs are reaching out to the more than 1 million immigrants in the D.C. area who may be unsure of the scope and impact of Secure Communities. Sarahi Uribe with the National Day Labor Organizing Network says it's vital for undocumented individuals to know their basic rights.
No law enforcement officer is supposed to inquire about a person's immigration status, and if someone is detained in the jail, they are not supposed to be interviewed by ICE officials unless they have a court order.
The Obama administration has vowed to implement Secure Communities nationwide by 2013, but immigrants' rights advocates in D.C. and across the country say they'll continue to organize against the program. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
Thank you to FSRN for those headlines. For more headlines, you can go to fsrn.org. That is our news show for Monday, June 4th.
Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news... contact...
Sorry. Claire is having some trouble.
Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed from our entire team at News 101. Thank you for joining us. Be sure to stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands.